Okay, so good afternoon. I think it's on. Is it on? I think so. So we're going through the questions to put them into categories. I will look through all the questions. We might not have time to answer them all. But we will see them all. She's not censoring them. She's merely putting them in categories so we can deal with the same questions at the same time. So the two she started me off with are, how do I cultivate urgency and swim against the stream while raising a child and being a householder and wife? And along with that is a question, how is it possible to delight in, find joy in a grandchild, a beautiful sunset, a puppy, or a good meal, and still not feel greed and craving? Okay, somebody else has asked if you can become enlightened as a layperson. So I'm going to be very traditional here. One time I was at dealing with the question of whether you can become enlightened as a layperson. It depends, first of all, what we mean by enlightenment. These nuns in the Theragata were aiming for arhat, to become an arhati, right? Which means completely seeing through the illusion of a separate self-inherent self, a sense of I, and directly seeing nirvana to the point that they were completely one with nirvana and never slipped back into samsara. That means to be an arhat. So then all the emotions, even down to their slight undercurrents, the emotions, the negative emotions, the afflictive emotions of our greed, grasping, anger, pride, jealousy, and ignorance, even down to the smallest tremor, were totally overcome. Right? Full liberation. I was at a conference one time, I think in Singapore, and on the platform was also the Australian monk Ajahn Brahm. And all the audience were Chinese. And someone asked that question, can I become enlightened as a layperson? And he said no. He said you have to become a monastic in order to become an arhat. And the audience was almost in tears. So I felt so sorry for them that I said, well, that's the Theravadin view. But from the point of view of Mahayana, the point is that I said from the point of view of Mahayana, it was not, the monastic side of it was not so important. The important side was the liberation of the mind. But of course, the question is that we do need, the Mahayana, of course, is not trying to attain nirvana. They are trying to attain full enlightenment of a Buddha. So that takes also much longer. But it also doesn't rely totally on it. The emphasis is more on opening up to our inherent wisdom, compassion, mind, not only uprooting all the negative emotions, the afflictive emotions. So therefore, in time, it was recognized that the mind does not take ordination. Only the body takes ordination. So if the mind remains an afflicted mind, then monastic or lay, it's just as bad. If the mind is completely immersed in our inherent, deathless wisdom, then it likewise does not matter whether we are monastic or lay. Because the nature of the mind, our Buddha nature, is not monastic or lay. It's also not male or female, right? It goes beyond all categories. However, the lifestyle of a renunciate can be very helpful. It lowers our desires, hopefully, and at the same time allows, also hopefully, more time for study and practice. Since a lot of our spiritual progress depends on loosening our grasping mind, it is easier if we do not have objects of strong desire, to deal with. The problem is not the grandchildren, beautiful sunset puppy, or good meal. The problem is our grasping mind at those objects. So this has to be understood also, that non-attachment doesn't exclude love and compassion. The Buddha, as we say, likened genuine love, genuine loving kindness, to a mother with a child. The only difference being that a mother to the child often, the idea, the pure love, in that the mother loves the child more than herself. That's the point. That the mother would gladly sacrifice herself, her health, her well-being, for the sake of the child, whom she loved so much, in a very pure way, insofar as at that moment of her love, the child is not giving much back. You know, the child is saying, "Oh, my heart." You know? She hopes in the future the child will be a little appreciative, but in the meantime, the child is just there, but the mother's love is in a way very pure because she's not, you know, her love is for the well-being of the child. The problem is that love is usually only for her child. And so to use that as the basis to cultivate an unconditional love for all beings, recognizing that all beings are deserving of love and compassion, is the starting point for the metta meditation. So what I'm trying to say is that the object is not the problem. Providing our relationship to the object is based on love and appreciation and not on grasping. So there is a difference between, the problem comes with our grasping, our attachment. If we can hold things gently and lovingly and caringly without wanting to own them, then we will be okay. But it's as soon as we try to hold on to something, cling to something, imagine that something is what is bringing us happiness, then we're in trouble. Do you understand? I mean, sometimes I say that attachment says, "I love you and I want you to make me happy." Whereas genuine love says, "I love you and I want you to be happy." If that includes me, that's nice. If it doesn't include me, I just want you to be happy. So that's the difference. Love liberates, but attachment imprisons us and is the root of all our insecurity. Because we hold on to something, hoping we can keep it and fearing that we will lose it. And so this creates a lot of anxiety inside us. Whereas genuine love just holds very gently, very lightly. And therefore doesn't create suffering. And doesn't keep us chained to samsara. So it's easier, therefore, to be in a situation where there are not temptations. Right? It's very tempting in the family or in a very pleasing environment to want to develop attachment towards it. It's easier in a very simple environment and with comrades who are not, we do not have the intensity of a deep intimate relationship with. But if we do are in those kind of relationships, if we're married or with our partners, if we have children and so forth, the partners are not the problem. The problem is the amount of our grasping at the relationship. That's the problem. So many lamas are married, they have children and families, and they love them. But if one or other of them dies, they can accept that because of understanding that, you know, everything is impermanent, but also because their love is based on true appreciation and not on the need to hold tight in case, we ourselves suffer from separation. Do you understand what I'm talking about? I mean, it's not, people think, non-attachment is cold and unfeeling. It's nothing about that. The Buddha very much emphasized, that we should have loving kindness towards all beings, that we should have compassion towards all beings. He says somewhere in here about the duties of a wife toward a husband, the duties of a husband to the wife. And, I mean, it's all about caring and loving and taking care of them. But the problem is that if we want to be liberated, not just be nicer people and walk on the spiritual path, but if we actually want to become arahats in this lifetime, it can only be done through a genuine, profound, irreversible realization of the nature of egolessness, which would simultaneously destroy all our afflictive emotions, including attachment. Right? So of yourself, if you really get deep enough insight, all negativity here is the attachment, not the love. So through realizing egolessness, our whole relationship with everything would completely be transformed. Of course it would. I mean, we think, I want to be enlightened, but I don't want to give anything up. And I don't want anything really to change, except I want to be happy. But that's not it. Of course, at a deeper level, one would have incredible happiness, but it would be the happiness of freedom. So this is why normally it is said that a layperson could get to the third level of non-returner. They would not become an arahat without completely renouncing the world. In the Stavyravada system. Because it's very difficult to really let everything go without having outwardly renounced as well as inwardly renounced. I struggle with the idea of parents, male and female, leaving their children to follow the path. It seems to be at the antithesis of loving kindness when children are vulnerable and need care. Please explain. Yes, indeed. I mean, we can all sympathize with that. On the other hand, if the Buddha had not left his palace and his child and his wife, we would not be sitting here today discussing it. Because if he had stayed in his palace, he would have been a great king, but he would not have been a Buddha. And so although it is very hard, and I'm sure any parent that leaves their children feels it very deeply, there's sometimes this inner call which overcomes the natural maternal or paternal feelings. It's such a deep inner necessity to renounce that it has to be followed. And that is just the way it is. All throughout history, that has been like that. Marcik Lapdaran, who was the great yogini, who was the founder of the Chur tradition, she also left her children and went and lived in a cave for many, many years. Later, her children came to her and became themselves great masters. But in the meantime, I mean, they were left with their father. And so, yes, on one level, our instinct is to say, how could we leave our children, especially when they are young? But sometimes there is a call which overcomes and is deeper than our normal call, our animal instincts, really, to stay with our young and protect them and love them. It's not that they don't love their children, but nonetheless, the call for the spiritual life is more urgent. And for that reason, I mean, a small percentage can even give up the needs of the family life and their children for the sake of something which feels really much more deep and true to their inner being, not just to our normal instincts that, you know, we should stay with our family and take care of our family. So this is a deeper loving kindness, a deeper compassion than merely for the people that in this lifetime we happen to be connected with. It is in order to really discover our own inner wisdom and compassion, which can serve all beings, not just the few that karmically we're connected with now. So that's the reason why. It's not because they are cold or unfeeling, and often for them also there is the pain of separation. But nonetheless, it's a call which they know has to be answered. So their goal is something much greater than merely the well-being of just the few. It's encompassing the well-being of the manifold. What is missing from the Dharma such that earnest practitioners such as monks still succumb to cultural misconduct such as misogyny and eating animals? Well, human beings are human beings. What can you say? It is indeed. I mean, many people are indeed puzzled by the degree of misogyny in people who otherwise have so much love, compassion, and wisdom. I remember when His Holiness the Gyawan Karmapa came to our nunnery and he apologized that nuns had for centuries been overlooked and denied access to the deeper teachings and the deeper practices. And he said he was very sorry about that, but now everything was changed, and now the nuns had, you know, the opportunities for all the practices and all the studies and everything, and there was nothing they could not do as women. That nowadays they realize that women had absolutely as much potential, if not more, than their male counterparts, and therefore there was nothing that they could not achieve. But you wonder whether he would have come to that decision had he not met with a lot of, you know, red-hot feminists in his life who, you know, pointed out the iniquities of it. And now that they have looked at it, they recognized that there was this imbalance. Why? For so many centuries, for millennia, really, they didn't notice. I don't know. Because definitely anybody meets, you know, with advanced monks or teachers and lamas and so forth, they are definitely filled with compassion and wisdom. There's no doubt about that. But somehow there are these blind spots in the society which has caused them to not even notice. Because also one thing is the women don't complain. The women themselves are conditioned to accept their role as inferior beings. And because of their own negative karma, not worthy of being trained and given opportunities like the males have. So they never complained. They accepted their role. And so there was nobody to kind of, you know, until they came to, to the West, where nowadays, not before, please remember ladies, but nowadays at least, women are equally educated and are able to speak up for themselves. So in this modern world which we live in, the lamas couldn't answer the question, why weren't women overlooked for so long? But I think in their own societies, the reason was because the women accepted their subordinate position and didn't question it and regarded it as a result of their own, you know, bad karma, and just prayed very hard that next lifetime they would come back as males who would then, you know, again forget all about the women. Right? They weren't aspiring to be women who would stand up for women. They just wanted to have a male body so that they didn't need to be women anymore. Right? So this, I think, is what happened, is that the society, the women weren't complaining and the men never noticed. And so it continues on until the present day when, you know, now we start to question these things. And as to animals, again, I don't know why so many Buddhists still eat animals. I cannot understand it. I don't know. It is very strange. There are so many options nowadays. There is simply no reason to eat other living beings. You sit down, you do meditation on wishing all beings to be well and happy and free from suffering. And in the Tibetan tradition, a lot of meditation and emphasis on how all beings have been our mothers in past lifetimes and how we must really vow to save them and take care of them. And then you sit down to a meal of fish or meat. And nobody seems to think that's odd. Even the suffering, the terror, everything which is connected with the meat industry. And yet nobody thinks there's a problem. I do think there is a problem. Right from the top all the way down, there's a problem with eating the flesh of another living being, which, as the Buddha said, their own life is most precious for them. I mean, yes, there is true that in the Vinaya it says that that monks can eat any meal if it is said that you didn't kill yourself, you didn't ask for it to be killed, and as far as you know, it wasn't killed on your behalf. But, as I said this morning, this nun Dhammananda in this bhikkhuni Dhammananda in Thailand, she has let her followers know that she is a vegetarian, so they prepare vegetarian food. It's no problem for them. So the monks could just let it be known that, of course, they will eat anything, but, you know, actually, they would rather be vegetarian if it's possible. Then next thing you know, they'd all be vegetarian. But they don't want to be, because they like meat, because they like fish. So, unlike the Jains, mentioned this morning, who are very, very scrupulously vegetarian. The Buddhists are very hypocrites. They talk about loving kindness to all sentient beings and then sit down and devour their flesh. But, and there's no excuse. I'm not going to make an excuse about it. It's just that people like to eat what they like to eat. And many people are very carnivorous and they don't see why they should change. I mean, and saying, as the Tibetans do, oh, well, it's a blessing to be eaten by a big llama. Ask the animal first. Since the own God, since the presidential election, and with everything that has been going on since, I have been sadder and angrier than usual. How can I keep my heart open and be accepting without becoming complacent? How do I cultivate joy in the midst of so much heartbreak? Well, I mean, first of all, read history. If we read history, we will see that this planet has always been in a mess. It is mostly ill-governed by whoever is in charge. And there is always wars, there is always violence, there is always appropriation of other people's properties and despoblation of the earth. Of course, it is now reaching, as our greed gets more, so the earth is becoming more and more despoiled. Who? Why? Because people are buying and wanting more, 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 all around the world. And as the Buddha said, you know, greed is like salty water. The more you drink, the thirstier you get. And we can see it. But the 20th century produced two world wars in which millions of people died, especially young people. Everywhere there's been wars, oppression, totalitarian states, terrible things happening, dreadful dictators. It's nothing new. Don't think you're so special in having a dubious leader. Many countries have. I mean, we were recently in Latin America, and in three of the countries we visited, their president was in prison for corruption and other things. You know, I mean, it's common. The important thing is not to add to the atmosphere of anger and paranoia. We talk a lot about the pollution of this planet and photographs shown of, you know, over big cities, the pall of pollution around. But what they can't show is the pollution, the psychic pollution, which is generated by people's thoughts and emotions. And nowadays, especially the poisons of our greed and our anger and fear and jealousy and competition, if we could see those, then we would see this planet is covered with thick darkness. So, we need to send out light. We don't need to plug in to the atmosphere of paranoia and anger. By being angry with your government or with the world or with industrialists or whoever, we are simply adding more darkness. We're simply creating more of the same. That's why it's very important to neutralize this negative energy by sending out positive energy. sending out loving kindness, sending out compassion, filling ourselves with those feelings, and then radiating it out throughout your town, your province, your country, the world, everywhere, filled with the light of love and compassion. You've got to put good energy into the world, not end up just feeling sorry for yourselves. How much problems we cause for others, and it comes back. So stop indulging in negativities and feeling virtuous about it. It's nothing virtuous about being negative. Be a bit positive. Send out good energy into the world. Not just this country, all the countries of the world, all the beings in the world, not just the human beings, the animals, the insects, the fish, birds, every being. Give every being on this planet love. Tara represents fearless compassion. It's feminine. A mother has fearless compassion. So this is what we need. Fearless love, fearless compassion. Not sitting feeling sorry for ourselves or even for the country, but an inner conviction of how love ultimately, however long it takes, is more powerful than hatred. Compassion is more powerful than cruelty. We have to believe in that, even if, you know, it doesn't evolve in, you know, our lifetime. Ultimately, that is truth. The rest is all falsehood. And in the end, truth will triumph. So send out some positive energy here. How do we release from the obsession of romantic love? Ha, ha, ha. You said it. It's an obsession. I would say get married. That will solve that. So, why did you decide to become a monastic, and how did you do you look back on the decision? You know, when I was a small child, I would draw pictures of nuns in prayer. These were Catholic nuns, because I only knew about Catholic nuns. And at that time, I wanted to be a nun. I wanted to be the kind of nun who was in an enclosed order and never came out. My only concern was that I wasn't really a Christian, and so then when I was about 11 or 12, I remember being in a neighboring shop. And so the neighbors all said to me, "Oh, you're getting a big girl now. What are you going to do when you grow up?" And I said, "I'm going to be a nun." And they were completely shocked. And I was surprised too. I hadn't realized that until that moment, that that's what I was going to do. But as I said, and they said, "Oh, you wait, you'll grow up, you'll soon change your mind." And I thought, no, I won't. And I was intrigued because I knew I was going to be a nun. But as I said, I didn't believe in Christianity. So I couldn't quite see how I was going to be a nun. But I always knew I absolutely didn't want to get married. And that I wanted to be a nun. So that's why I'm a nun. And it took, after I became Buddhist when I was 18, And at that time, it was mostly Theravadin Buddhism in London. This is in the early 60s. And for months, I only read monks. And it took time before I realized there were nuns. Nobody ever mentioned them. But when I realized there were nuns, then it was obvious that was what I was up to. So I'm so grateful to myself. He said, how do you look back on the decision? I'm so grateful to myself that I knew at an early age that was what I wanted to do. And I have never, even for one moment, regretted that decision. So there. I mean, it doesn't mean everybody has to become monks and nuns. Obviously not. I mean, how would the Buddhist world progress if everybody became monks and nuns? But I think if you do have that strong desire for leaving home for homelessness, that one should listen to it. And it's in Buddhism, unlike in like in India, in Hinduism, it's very frowned upon for girls to leave home. And so I often meet with young Indian girls who say that they would love just to lead a spiritual life, but their family are pushing them very much to get married. And they don't, in Buddhist countries, with all the faults of Buddhist countries as well as the virtues, one of the virtues is that there's always that choice. If you want to not get married, you can become a nun. There's not normally a third alternative of just staying as an unmarried woman. But there is always the choice that if you want to lead a spiritual life and you don't want to lead the family life, you can do that, and that is acceptable. Could you talk about your decision to teach and support for bhikkhunis rather than spending all your time in retreat? Well, I mean, after I left retreat, then... I went to Italy for a while. I was very interested at that point in reconnecting with Western culture, because I became Buddhist when I was 18. So after that, I left all my interest in Western culture and only read Buddhist texts and absorbed myself in the Dharma. Then I went to India when I was 20, and so I was in India for 24 years, and then. Anyway, for various reasons, I had to leave India. So I wanted to reconnect. I felt it was time to reconnect with Western culture. After all, I was born in England. There must have been a reason for it. And I really wanted to reconnect. So then some friends of mine had just moved to Italy. So they said, come to Italy. And I thought, the place, for Western culture, that's it. So I went there and steeped myself for some time in Western culture, especially in medieval Catholicism and the church and all the saints and that. I mean, Italy's the place for that. And art, and the great art of medieval and Renaissance, etc. Then I came back to India. I tried at that time to go into retreat. In fact, somebody even built me a beautiful little wooden house. But every time there would be severe obstacles, really severe. I mean, one obstacle ended up in hospital. And so I tried again and again to go into a retreat situation. Everybody was very supportive, but every time there would be, like, the door slammed, no. Like, for example, one time I was going to be in retreat in this very remote house. There were no other houses around. It was perfect. My friend said, yes, you can stay there for the winter. So it had no telephone. And I said, whatever you do, don't interrupt me for three months. I don't want to see anybody. Right. And then on the second morning, I tried to get up and I couldn't get up. And I was attacked by this incredible pain. And I was crawling on the floor. It was very, I started laughing because I thought, well, here I am, 2 months, don't come anywhere near me. No way of contacting anybody. And here I am, I can't even move. Somehow I thought that was funny. So that's when I eventually, after 2 months, ended up in hospital. But anyway, the point was that every time I tried to go back into retreat, there were these obstacles coming. So then I thought, okay, I should go back to India. And my idea to go back to India was to start teaching English to the incarnation of my Lama, who at that time was 12. So I went back to India to teach him English. And then the Lamas had a meeting, the big Lamas all had a meeting. And then they said, well, we want you to start a nunnery. We don't have anything for women, and so you please start something. And when they said that, then I thought, yes, this is what I came back to India for, not just to teach English to Rinpoche. If I don't do it, who will? And my root guru had said to me, I want you to start a nunnery. He said it several times, and I just said, yes, Rinpoche, let it go, because... You know, I had no money. I had no anything. How'd you start a nunnery? But, so that's why I felt at that time, now is the time to do something for Himalayan nuns. That this was the opportunity now. If we don't do it, who's going to do it? They were not educated. They were living in great poverty. Many of them still lived at home as kind of unmarried daughters, doing all the housework, and totally uneducated and untrained. And so it seemed like this was the time to start helping them in their struggle to come together and to be educated, to study Buddhist philosophy, to learn debating, to learn... meditation practices and ritual, and really rise in the Dharma world, because I think that the balance needs to be there. And so that's what we did, and now we have about 106, 108 nuns from the Himalayan regions, and they're all studying and practicing, and they're very well, actually. Now my concern is more for our sisters in the faith who are in the West, who, especially in the Tibetan tradition, are not supported at all, either by their lamas or by the lay people, and who struggle very much because they have no training, and having received ordination are then left to their own devices to work out for themselves how they're going to survive. And so many of them do not survive as nuns. They're, in the recent weeks, at least four of my old-time Dharma sisters have disrobed. Just out of disheartened. You know, they just... Nobody cares. Nobody helps them. They feel very isolated, very alienated from society, and pretty hopeless. So now our interest is in trying to help them. Any funds which we raise from this weekend, the portion given to us, will be given for our Alliance for Non-Himalayan Nuns, which means nuns both Asian and Western who join the Tibetan tradition and then find themselves afloat with no support on any sides. So... If one reaches nirvana, does that mean they do not reincarnate into any other life? Well, this, of course, is the one of the main divisions of opinion between the Mahayana and the Theravadin school. In the Theravadin school, of course, once you have really realized nirvana to the point of being an arahat, which these nuns were acquiring, then you enter into nirvana, to parinirvana, and you don't reincarnate. That's the whole point. Is that, you know, now having gone beyond the ego, there is no ego to reincarnate, right? I mean, normally we reincarnate because our consciousness goes on, our ordinary, and we are driven along by our karma, by the actions of body, speech, and mind, which we have committed in this and other lifetimes. But once we realize egolessness, and otherwise, once we realize nirvana, then there is no doer of the deeds. Right? You understand? Okay. These are my little karmas. Okay. These are my karmas, right? One after the other after the other. So if I pull one, the others all follow. Round and round and round and round and round, right? What's holding them together? The thread. The thread is the belief in an actor behind the actions, a me who did these actions, and therefore is going to get the results. Anyway, when I do something, I think I did it. Cut that, and maybe one deep bead will come up, but no other beads will follow. Right? So that's the point of attaining to the level of an arhat, is that you cut the thread of the ego, the thread of the idea of a doer behind all our deeds. When that is gone, all our negative emotions naturally disappear, because our greed and our anger and pride and so forth all depend on the idea of I. This doesn't please me, this does please me, etc. Right? When that completely drops and we are in a level of awareness which is described as all-pervading, unconditioned, unborn, deathless, and so forth, a whole different level of our being, which is our true being, which we normally don't see because it's covered over by our conceptual egoistic mind. When that drops away and we see reality face to face, then who is to be reborn? So that is the position of the Theravada school, among other schools of that nature. In the Mahayana, then, the idea was that that would be very selfish, even you losing yourself. But that what desiring liberation only for oneself and leaving behind everyone else, if we are in a prison house and we escape, wouldn't we want to also help others to escape? This is the point. If we are all drowning in the swamp of existence, if we got on dry land, would we then turn to all our family and friends and loved ones and say, well, I'm on dry land, so you work hard and you can get on dry land too. Okay, ciao. You know, we would say, I'm on dry land, so I'm going to help you to get on dry land too. So this is the aspiration of the Mahayana, that even though they gain great levels of insight, it also at the same time arouses great compassion. And so they renounce nirvana, or they keep nirvana as the other side of the coin of samsara, and aspire not to become just arahats. There are Mahayana arahats, but not just to become arahats, but become fully enlightened Buddhas in order to be able to be of universal benefit for others. So you can realize nirvana, but choose not to enter into nirvana, but to keep being reborn in endless different states of being, purely for the benefit of others. Okay, are trees and plants sentient? If not, what are the causes and conditions that make them live? According to Buddhism, they are not sentient because they do not incarnate. They are not part of the cycle. Animals, for example, according to Buddhist thought, we can get reborn as animals. Animals can get reborn in the human realm. We're all part of the cycle of birth and death. But plants are not. They don't have the kind of intelligence of, and they belong to a different cycle. They are not part of the cycle which are considered to be sentient beings. This does not mean that in many ways they are not sensitive. They may even have an intelligence, but they are not part of the rebirth cycle. So you cannot pray to be reborn as a tree. You could be reborn as a spirit in a tree, but not as a tree itself, because the tree itself is not sentient. I mean, they are sensitive. I mean, as you know, how are we doing with time? I won't go on to explaining why plants are sensitive. Huh? Yeah, well. I like this one. How do I know if I'm experiencing nirvana? I wouldn't worry about it. I mean, the things we worry about, right? How did you know it was time to leave the cave? Well, a police officer came and knocked on my door and handed me a notice from the superintendent of the police telling me to come down the next day because I had 3 days left in the country. So that's how I knew it was time to leave the cave. I mean, I didn't leave just then, but I mean, basically that finished my retreat. So about these plants, I mean, I think it's very important to recognize that plants are sensitive and they do respond, but nonetheless, they are not part of the cycle of birth and death in the same way that animals, insects, humans, and so forth are. If we are all made of emptiness, the deathless, why was samsara and ego created? In other words, why through rebirth do we forget? Why birth from the beginning? The thing is that the Buddha himself, when somebody asked, well, why are we stuck here, endlessly revolving, he gave the famous example of the arrow. And he said, if someone is shot by a poison arrow and we want to pull the arrow out, and then they say, no, don't touch it. I want to know first what kind of bird made up the wing feathers and what kind of wood the staff is made of and what was the caste of the person who made this arrow and the one that shot it and so on and so on. And he said, you'd be dead before you found out the answers to all these questions. The thing is, pull the arrow out. So samsara is a cycle. In Asian thought, there is not the idea there was a beginning and then there will be an end. It's a cycle. Even cosmology is a cycle. There is times when the universe comes into being. When it stays stable, then it implodes again, and then there are periods of great darkness, inconceivable amounts of time. And then gradually, because of the karma of the beings who inherited that universe, then again the universe comes into being, stays, goes again. It's endless. This is why samsara is said to be beginningless and endless. Our kind of conceptual thinking, we always have to think there has to be a beginning and then there'll be an end. But it's not like that. There's no beginning, there's no end, just endlessly going on and on and on. And so, I don't think that anybody has ever come up, and the Dzogchen have a way of looking at it about ripples on a quiet lake coming up. But why, since our inherent nature is the deathless, is the unconditioned, is Buddha nature, how is it that we got so screwed up? It's a good question. I'm not sure that there is really an answer. The answer is, who knows why, but here we are, let's undo the tangle. Because the good news is always that however messed up we may feel ourselves to be, in a moment we could be free. if only we could recognize the nature of the mind. Nirvana isn't out there. Nirvana is our true nature. We just have to wake up and realize it. It's not a long journey. I mean, as these nuns have shown, some of them instantly awoke. Some of them spent years and years and years. It's not a matter of time. It's not a matter of creating something which we don't have. It's a matter of waking up to what we do have. And so this is our only problem. Always, however deluded we may feel ourselves to be, our essential nature never changes. We are the culmination of wisdom and compassion. It's just got covered over so we don't see. So the traditional example is of a beggar who goes out every day to get a few coppers, a few cents. But all the time in his hovel, underground, there is a huge treasure. He's actually a millionaire, a billionaire. But he doesn't know. So if he gets a dollar or two, he feels himself rich. But all the time, the treasure is just lying there, waiting to be discovered. But he's looking in the wrong place. And so that's what Buddhist meditation is about. It's coming back to our true nature, which we have never left. But we just don't recognize it. We don't have to manufacture it. Nobody's going to give it to us. We have to see it for ourselves. And when we see it, we know it. I wouldn't worry about how will I know Nirvana. When you get there, you'll know. Don't worry. When you get there, there won't be anyone to know. As long as we think, oh, I've got Nirvana, we haven't. As long as we think I'm enlightened, we're not. But it's good news because it's saying ultimately we are all healthy. We are all Buddhas. We are all enlightened. We just have to recognize our true nature and stop identifying with our false nature. That's why you meditate. To recognize that all of this stuff which comes up, it's not me, it's not mine. There's something else, that pure, unborn awareness behind it all, like the sky, covered with thick clouds, but it's the sky. The sky is always there. The clouds come from the sky, they go back in, but the sky is always there. Space is everywhere. Where is space not? So that's our true nature. That's why you practice, not to feel better, but to recognize that which we have never ceased to be, but we just don't know. Okay, may you all be very well and happy and continue with your practice.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.